From Sylvain Labs, welcome to Critical Nonsense. On our show, we dig deep into cultural ephemera and pose questions to each other to inspire interesting conversations. This is Critical Nonsense. This week, Joey asks me, Jess, about a soft generation, and I ask Joey about luxuriousness.
This is what a Joey sounds like.
And you know me, this is Jess.
And this is what a special guest, commentator, host, participant, pundit, Camille Drucker sounds like.
Morning, sunshine.
Oh my gosh, yes. I could not have asked for anything better.
Now the day can begin.
Truly.
Yeah. So I'm going to start this week. And as with seemingly all of my questions for this show, it's sort of like a bunch of complimentary signals that I'm seeing that I kind of want to talk about. And right now there's, well, I guess for the past decade, there's been conversations about millennials, you know, where
typical millennial maneuver.
Yeah, oft love target for criticism. But that's sort of what I want to talk about. Right now, there are at least three things that I've been seeing that are sort of related around this idea of millennial sensitivity, maybe. Let's call it that.
Which, to clarify, 2.5 of the three of us right now are millennials.
Yeah, you still count. You're just on the low end, and I'm on the high end.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm right in the middle.
Yeah. we have all temperatures of porridge available to us. But this sensitivity issue, I think, has come up. But so I'll tell you the three things that I've been seeing, cool. And then we can jump into it. There has been, I don't think I would even call it a scandal, but there was a lot of talk about when Amy Klobuchar announced her candidacy for president. She's a senator from Minnesota. There was a piece that was run, I think, on HuffPost, but then other places picked up the story as well around her being a really tough boss, and it seemed to have come out of three young staffers, and a bunch of other people came in and talked about it, and like, yeah, she's kind of hard, but she's not abusive, but specifically the language that was used around her was abusive. So that's one. Two is there's been sort of an increased conversation that I've been seeing, and I don't know if this is anecdotal or not, around morale within like startup community types and like maybe tech bros. I don't know if they're bros or not, but in that world, I've seen things like, you know, what's harder than getting funding is maintaining morale at your startup. And then there's also this other thing that's happening in the NBA right now where like star athletes are getting frustrated in, you know, they're on like a 4-year contract and they're getting really frustrated with the organization or something in the middle and trying to cut out of their contracts. And so it leaves me wondering, like, are millennials soft? And if so, what makes a generation soft?
I love this, especially because it requires maybe some self-reflection, and also because I think similar to the kinds of environments that you're describing, this sort of like, I don't know if maybe not political campaign rooms or teams, but definitely in startup communities and definitely at the kind of place that we work, there's sort of a closer range of ages, right? Mm-hmm. We're sort of looking at a small group and right now of mostly millennial people. Our company is almost entirely comprised of, if not completely comprised of, millennials.
Pretty close,
right?
Pretty close.
And so there's an interesting, we can sort of analyze and study this microcosm of sensitivity in this space, right? And specifically reflecting on our own experience.
Yeah, and I think like there's the other aspect of this, right? That, you know, millennials is too wide sweeping of a term to be meaningful. I mean, even like in conversations about music, I've seen stuff about like young millennials versus old millennials. Like old millennials love Drake, young millennials love, you know, chants or something like that. So there is sort of like a divide with even within millennials in terms of maybe mind state.
Right. But that, I think, aside, we still can for sure attack this subject of softness, right? Because I think it is almost to a sad trope associated with millennials and, oh, those darn millennials and they're so sensitive. I think we should take your points one by one because I think they're pretty separate.
Yeah, I would say I think the thread is that we should try and tackle is sort of working through adversity. That's sort of what I'm kind of seeing as it, like startup environments are hard. They create challenges that are unique to a new company that, you know, an established organization doesn't have, right? So that's sort of an adversity. Like being an NBA player while you are very well compensated and probably have like a baller lifestyle, literally. The working through an NBA season is a slog. I mean, it is physically and emotionally taxing. And so there's a lot of adversity in that. And then working on a campaign or for someone on Capitol Hill is difficult. So there's sort of like in those three situations, there is sort of this like dealing with adversity thread.
For sure. Though I think point number one about Amy Klobuchar and that whole situation, to me, it's screaming interesting gender dynamic moment and what it's like to have a female boss in 2019. Mm-hmm.
Totally.
Camille.
This might be a tangent, but it's making me think about what we're conditioned to think of as normal. And mm-hmm. this is both in terms of the gender, but more generally in terms of what is adversity.
Yeah.
And I feel like every generation or even at any moment in culture, we're being taught this is adversity versus this is a normal. For example, mm-hmm. you know, older generations that grew up during the Great Depression were taught that you just have to deal with this. This is what's normal. Or the boomers were just taught that what was normal was doing the 9 to 5 and being stable. And, you know, I don't know exactly what I'm saying, but basically, are we being told, you know, it is the line of where we're soft and where we're able to take on adversity conditioned by what we're told is the stuff we should be able to take on as mm-hmm. the norm and the stuff that span outside of the realm of the norm.
Yeah. And, you know, that also makes me think of the expectation around these three things in particular, which are politics, tech startup culture and sport culture are some of the three sort of romanticized cultural
totally.
Spaces right now at the fore of discussion. And so I imagine, especially for younger, you know, the chance loving millennials might come into that space and not have per se a realistic expectation around what that's supposed to be like or what that's supposed to look like.
Well, it's also interesting, like your point about the romantic, they're quite different environments, right? Like
Absolutely.
Capitol Hill, the, you know, an NBA locker room and a startup bar in San Francisco, coffee shop in San Francisco, whatever. The environments are so different, but you're seeing sort of a similar conversation happening. And, you know, it makes me think about the Jonathan Haidt book of like the coddling of the American mind or I think that's what it was called. But the normal point that you're making, Camille, is an interesting one. And tying back to what you brought up about the Amy Klobuchar point about like sort of screaming gender dynamics and the question of what is or isn't normal. Like some of those environments are rife with abuse. And I think part of what we're seeing is that in at least these conversations, there is sort of the dynamic of saying we've been fighting back on abuses. And at some point, like, you know, we haven't solved all of those abuses, right? Like sexual harassment or diversity or inclusion, like all of those problems aren't solved, but it starts to make you think about like an immune system gone awry, like where the immune system's fighting so hard, where like what is normal, like we're establishing what is normal, and like someone telling you your work isn't good enough, is that seems like an opportunity for growth versus like a situation where someone is legitimately abusive, right? Like in the Amy Klobuchar case, or example, not court case, the language that was used was abusive, right? And other staffers came in and were like, that, I mean, she's tough. She's like a tough boss, but she's always been nice. She's like called us in situations and been supportive and all of this. So it's sort of like, is someone telling you your work is bad or not up to snuff? Is that abusive?
Well, okay. So I guess this always, I think, when written about, comes back to, you know, were these millennials as kids ever really, you know,
y'all got a trophy,
reprimanded? Yeah, exactly. You know, you got everything that you wanted and you never had to go through adversity. But I just can't believe that. Right? That just cannot possibly
be true.
What a
young millennial.
And well, that, and also I just think that the types of adversity might be shifting, right? The mental health challenges that are so much more prevalent today than they ever were. And I guess I wonder, is the reason that there's that disconnect about maybe the language of toughness and toughness
softness
versus abuse, or
is,
you know, maybe it's because the types of adversity experienced by millennials, you know, earlier on were not the kinds to prepare them for that situation, but they are better prepared for some other situation. I just can't imagine that there isn't some kind of softness, toughness displacement. You know, what, yeah, like there has to be some kind of balancing of the scales.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think the NBA dynamic is sort of interesting because people are like, you know, you're making, you know, $25 million, $30 million a year for some of these like high end. I mean, the Supermax contracts now are going up to like $40 million a year. And some of these athletes are like, you're angry with your boss, but you signed a contract and you're making $40 million. And some people are just like, you know, like, suck it up. Like, you signed a contract, just finish your contract. And other people are like, oh, you know, like, he's not getting the environment he wants, and player empowerment and these other dynamics. And so, like, there is, even in the commentary about those situations, there's not sort of consensus of, I think you are seeing generational divides. I think, like, older folks in that example, like, older sports fans are like, you signed a contract, just work, just right, finish your contract.
But then I guess what is it though that makes them, what makes this a new phenomenon, or makes this, that kind of situation for an athlete, a really awesome professional sports player, you know, what makes that so hard for them?
Well, I think it's like there's an increased media scrutiny as part of this, and they're like opening themselves up to the media more and things like that. But there is sort of, in your point, Camille, about sort of norms, right? Like, norms are set culturally, and the other players that they're associating with are their own age. And there's, you know, like, you can imagine someone saying like, you don't need to deal with that environment, like, you should move, tell them you want to trade or whatever it is. But we're in like a window right now of that sort of unprecedented, where people like superstar, like elite, like top, you know, 15 players in the league are asking for movement in their contract, in the middle of their contract. Like, in the past 2 years, there's been like, I can think of like five, which is, it never happened before.
And that kind of goes in line with this idea of, again, consensus, or I don't know if normal was the right word or consensus, but whether it's amongst players within the NBA or whether it's in culture at large, there's been a more mass and consensus-y type of conversation around prioritizing the self, prioritizing mental health, prioritizing your own well-being. Mm-hmm. And if that conversation has become the new norm or the new priority almost, then it almost seems as though across spaces, whether it's in the workplace, whether it's in politics, whether it's in sports, that people are seeing that as the normal is I prioritize me. And mm-hmm. so I filter all of my experiences, regardless of whether it's a $40 million contract or it's, you know, my day-to-day job, as is it meeting the norm, you know, the standards that I should be meeting. And if that's personal well-being versus security, financial security, then maybe that's where some of the mm-hmm. problems are.
Yeah, that idea that there's this increased expectation or vision of the level that one should be at, you can imagine that you'd be like, hey, this isn't enough, this isn't right, whatever, because that puts so much pressure on somebody.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, it's interesting to think about it too through the lens of the self, and sort of like the far end of that spectrum is sort of like the narcissism conversation of being sort of so highly focused on yourself versus, you know, the team or the culture or the company or whatever it is that you're participating in, and being like, this is how you made me feel and my emotions are valid, right? Like that sort of, you know, in the Amy Klobuchar case, if like someone, there was a thing about like, you know, she gave severe criticism to someone about a press briefing or something like that, and the person's like, I went to Northwestern. I know about press briefings. Like, I don't like the way you make me feel, and that is valid. And I don't know if that's wrong. But that's new, right? Like that every emotion that you have is somehow valid because every emotion you put on social media or wherever is being sort of told that it's valid.
Yeah. And to that, I guess my last question is, you know, what are the good things that come out of a generation of softness?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's like this question about softness is sort of interesting, that it's producing people who are fighting back against actual abuses, right? Like,
yep.
Which is, I think, interesting and important, right? Like, my emotions are valid when I don't like when you're doing something legitimately wrong and this generation is fighting off. But it's also like my emotions are valid when, like, you
when
know,
sometimes they're not valid.
Yeah, when you told me my hair was slightly out of place and I'm suing.
Yeah, we're learning, right?
Yeah.
It's almost like we're in a generation that's trying to swing the pendulum back.
Yeah.
To, you know, if there's been kind of too much abuse or too much disregard for the self, or for personal well-being in the past, that we're almost trying to fight back, even if too extremely, to get back to a new,
yeah,
potentially more or better adjusted space. I don't know.
Homeostasis.
That's right. Equilibrium. Science terminology.
Millennials, the equilibrium generation.
So we're back, and I'm not going to comment on the ukulele break. And instead,
we didn't do it. Not
this
time.
Well, it's because I'm starting. But now I did it. Oh, well. I have to say that of all of the interesting projects that have flown through our doors, something has caught my eye that I think is going to be really cool for us to talk about today. And it has to do with luxury. And I know that, you know, from the classic conversations of like, today our modern sense of luxury is a $5 coffee, which is one version of it.
Yeah.
I think what's more interesting is sort of the broad scope of all of the different flavors of luxury, as you will, and not just in the sense of the taste of different coffees that are expensive, but in a sensory sense. That we are willing to pay just a little bit more if we're going to get the really nice subscription toothbrush because for some reason the feel of that is worth it. Or if we're going to spend a little bit more to go on a nice vacation in a bit of a fancier rental home of some unnameable brand. And so I guess it brings me to the question of what makes something luxurious in particular today?
You know, something you were saying is interesting to me. The idea that like we're all looking for luxury is, I think, a newer thing, right? Like, you know, my parents were not like indulging in everyday luxuries when I was growing up. You know what I mean? Like that wasn't their vibe. It doesn't really feel like, and that maybe that was cultural or a product of like how much money we had or whatever. But I feel like today you see this idea of like everyone finding opportunities to indulge in something luxurious that is a little bit more accessible or requires less of an investment, right? Like the idea that you could, you know, like, you know, I had a job at McDonald's when I was 14 and I could have like gone out and got a very luxurious coffee. Like I could afford that at that time with like the, I think I was making $5.25 when I first started working. And so like that idea that everyone has access to some little bit of luxury if they want is kind of interesting, because like historically luxury was like fine goods of like leather and, you know, sequins. are sequins luxurious? or like, you know, going to the Cayman Islands or the Seychelles or some sort of, you know, Tahoe. Or
right, the big ticket item things. You're right. Yeah. There is sort of a given here that sort of there is some kind of accessible luxury striving that we've all got going on. We all want to be able to treat ourselves a little bit. And we can, because moments of luxury are not necessarily smaller, but more attainable.
I mean, it's interesting, like, is the sensory component of it is interesting, right? Like a leather purse. I don't know. I don't have any leather goods. A leather purse.
That's really all he can describe. Is just, it's leathery. Yeah.
Feels like a nice leather supple purse. Feels nicer than a not nice leather purse. Like there is like actually like a sensory experience. And I was thinking like, is Supreme luxury? It's like expensive, but doesn't feel like it's made of anything nicer. It's just, it's exclusivity, right?
Yeah. And that actually, I think, brings up a really interesting point, which could be that, you know, in some sense are on certain senses things that we are really sensitive to and looking for. Are we discerning enough to decipher when something is actually sensorily luxurious, or are there certain senses that we are kind of numbed to and we don't actually think about it too much?
This is kind of a tangent, but I have a theory that's probably unfounded, that the way we experience luxury or we approach luxury today has to do for some reason with our obsession with time. And what I mean by this obsession with time is our obsession with making the most of our time. And this is all of the sensory experiences, and our obsession with beating time. And this is either getting pieces. This is the more, you know, high end pieces that will never go out of style and you will keep for 20 years, or the pieces that are only available for, you know, that 1 week, or there's like only a few of them. That's a temporary thing for Supreme, for example. So we have this obsession with somehow harnessing time, or like, oh, yeah.
I don't think that's tangent at all. And I think that is intrinsically attached to sight and vision. Particularly because, and I know I'm sort of a dead horse on, no, that's not, that's totally not the story. I just am the dead horse on the subject of this digital footprint being everlasting. The idea that the things that you see and the ways that you can capture moments in photos, that those last forever, mean that what actually is before your eyes and in between your eyes and the thing, your phone, that is sort of stopping time in a way, right? And with that obsession, perhaps one of the senses that we are pretty attuned to are our eyeballs.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, the amount of the attention economy puts a lot of value on eyeballs, right? But I'm trying to think about this idea of it being sensorial and whether that's actually a shift or not, or it's just that the fact that like more people are aware of the things that they don't or haven't had access to historically, and so there's more opportunity to covet those things.
Well, maybe, and this is just a hypothesis, but I wonder if it has to do with sort of, you know how they, whenever you deprive a certain sense, another one gets heightened immensely. Mm-hmm. I wonder if there's something like that where maybe going back to the leather thing where, you know, touching leather and being able to feel that, oh, this is a really nice material. Maybe we, per the Supreme comment, care less about touch and feel and more about sight and maybe a little bit sound. In the sense that music...
You're listening to this right now.
Yeah, also, right. Podcasts, right? I wonder if maybe we've sort of... we've created or it has been put upon us to have this sort of sensorial imbalance just because of what technology allows us today.
Mm. Yeah, I don't... I think I like the idea that we're over-focusing on our eyes and ears, and so that's why something like in paying more for food is kind of compelling, because we're feeding our other senses so much through the day, and so that like deprivation makes indulging in food or in touch or something like that more compelling, because we're like hyper attuned to this one sense.
I love that you brought up food, though, because I kind of think that we actually don't give that much attention to good tasting food as you might think that we do. And I think that's because it matters more often to get a good photo of something that looks good, which, as we know from the Japanese, thank you, Japanese people, that plating and the way that food looks is an integral part to the way that it tastes.
Mm-hmm.
But not every Instagram-worthy, ice cream shop is going to have the best ice cream.
Yeah.
You know, maybe we think that it is better just because it looks better, but, you know, maybe we aren't that good at figuring out what is the best ice cream anymore.
And also when it comes to smell, it's almost, fragrances used to be a huge part of luxury and accessible luxury at that. And there's been, at least I've seen, a lot less buzz and conversation around the fragrance space and industry. And maybe that's also part of that, which is if smell has taken kind of a back seat in favor of sight and maybe sound, it also starts to dictate which types of experiences and types of products we're going for, especially in the accessible luxury space.
Well, there's something interesting when you're going into like the sensory space. There's like like physiology, I guess, there's a concept called like just noticeable differences, and the idea of how attuned not just your individual sensory organs are, but like different parts of your sensory organ, right? Like if you touch a spot on your back and you move an inch away, in certain parts of your back, you won't be able to distinguish that as two different locations. But if you do a much shorter distance on like your finger, you can identify that that's like, you know, that same distance might have like six locations on it or something like that. And I think what's interesting to bring up that is like you can train your body to get better at it, and smell is sort of one area where, you know, everything has a smell now. Like we're you know, like every store has its own odor and every hotel has a signature, you know, the white tea smell of the Westin or things like that. And I think we're becoming more attuned and like the broadly speaking, like our, you know, I don't know what the equivalent of a palate in your nose is, your olfactory palate or I mean, as well as like our gastronomical palate are becoming expanded. Like people are having conversations and being able to identify, you know, in the way that people talk about wine. Now people talk about coffee that way or chocolate or these other things. And so we're by becoming smarter, it also allows you to indulge in something luxurious that, you know, maybe not to like the ultra extreme. I don't even know what like the ultra extreme olfactory experience is, right? Like what makes Chanel number 5 different from, you know, Curve or something like one of those like crappy, I don't know if Curve is actually crappy. I just remember people wearing it when I was in like middle school.
the two perfumes that Joey can pull from his memory are those two. Yeah, I guess it reminds me.
Dracar Noir.
Oh my God. I'll throw back to Princess Diaries. This reminds me of an article that our colleague Trevor sent me, which was about the sommeliers of everything, where they're, you know, they're expert honey tasters now and, you know, expert all sorts of different kinds of things that you never would have expected. But that's still, I imagine, isolated and not sort of a mass thing, probably because it does sort of require expertise, you know, not everyone can or has the technology or capability to discern differences between two types of honey, whereas anybody can be a photographer now. So
we're eyeball sommeliers, is what you're saying?
Kind of. And until we
Instagram
have,
influencers right, well, as eyeball sommeliers. Gross.
We just
gross.
Smell eyeballs of other people. No, I'm sorry. It's too wrong now. But
your eyeball smells and tastes delicious.
No.
I'm smelling rich red fruit.
Bold, full-bodied eyeballs. I do think though that until we have sort of whatever the next I hate saying frontier, but whatever the next thing is that's going to let us sort of be expert smellers en masse or expert feelers en masse. I don't know. Until we actually can sort of redistribute our attention to those senses, we're probably, I don't know. I don't know what you guys think, but I sort of think that we might just stay in this, you know, this sight and sound and non-smelling.
I smell like an expert.
Yeah.
I smell like an expert.
Are you a super smeller?
I'm super smelly.
Is that, that's weird. Do you think a super smeller would be identified by counting the number of nose hairs that you have? Just like a super taster is counting the number of taste buds that you have?
Interesting note to leave it on. There's theories that your olfactory bulb works on a quantum level, certainly on like in bloodhounds.
Wow. I was just watching the explain like a 5-year-old quantum computing. No, that's not. Explain. Why
to a 5-year-old.
Explain to a 5-year-old what quantum computing is.
Explain like a 5-year-old. It's big and loud and cold.
Yeah, that's it.
Critical Nonsense is a Sylvain Labs production.
Recorded in MacGyver Studios in New York, New York.
We'd like to thank executive producer and co-host, Jess Mander.
I'm doing it on Aaron's behalf. We'd also like to thank, of course, special guest commentator Camille Drucker.
Sound engineer Alex Contell, who's doing it remotely today, so we don't get to see his beautiful beard.
But it's still beautiful. And we'd like to thank designer Nora Mestrich for our awesome cover art.
Yeah, and being super tight. With production help from Sara Gilbert, Les Jacobs, and Tony Wong.
And as always, thanks, Alain.
Thanks, Alain. This week on Special Thanks,
we'd like to present
thanks.
That's not what, no. We'd like to present thanks for being special.
Thanks. Thank you to the theme song of the Golden Girls.
Why are we thanking the Golden Girls theme song?
Because it's thanking us for being a friend.
Oh, that makes sense. I'd like to thank tough women bosses around the world for being awesome.
Just being tough.
being tough, you know?
Jess can work for you. She appreciates your toughness, Amy Klobuchar. You can tell Jess that she produced the worst press briefing ever. She doesn't care.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I didn't even go to Northwestern, so, you know? Also, thank you to Northwestern for being a decent university.
Decent?
I don't know what that's going to mean.
Shots fired.
Great, no, excellent.
That was a drive-by on Northwestern.
Sorry. But also, go blue.
Aren't they purple?
No, Michigan. Oh, gosh. Come on, Joey. Okay, who else do we have to thank?
Chocolate. Yeah. For being luxurious.
True. And other sensory indulgences, like opening a jar of peanut butter and then being the first one to put the spoon into the peanut butter and then only making sure that you're scooping it out from the middle so that you you can tighten up the jar and put it back and someone thinks that they're about to get that opportunity, but then don't.
That's what we call conscientious luxury. No, I would like to thank the people who go around smelling things.
Who are those people?
Well, they're just people that smell things.
They got noses.
Yeah, that's sniffing a luxury. Around. They smell wines and farts.
Yeah. Actually, I'd like to thank the bees for creating...
For being
the ones with... Well, I don't know if bees have noses, but I know they go around pollinating all the flowers and probably sniffing along the way.
Actually, bees rely mostly on their eyes.
Whoa.
Ultraviolet.
Are we bees?
Will you be my Valentine?
Puns!
Thanks.
Sensitive on all fronts, millennials, the soft generation.
Turns out millennials are more sensitive. And when we call them soft, we just mean they sleep on Brooklyn in sheets.